Our next case is Red Dog Mobile Shelters versus Cat Industries, 16-1370. Mr. Smith, you reserved 7 minutes of your time for rebuttal. Okay, counsel ready? You may proceed.
May it please the court. Your honors, we're here today appealing the district court's granting of a motion for summary judgment of non-infringement against my client. There were three primary claim construction terms that were issued on that I'll group into three for discussion purposes. The first was claims that were directed to multiple rails that support, multiple rails or elongate members that support the protective shelter on the substrate. The second group of claims had to do with whether those rails also elevated a floor in claim 60. And the third group had to do with whether the cat shelter had ballast beneath the floor or beneath the first or second deck as required by claim 60 of the patent.
So the last two are just about one claim?
The last two only relate to claim 60, that is correct. And a review of the district court's opinion makes it very clear that, let me step back a second. Appellees are correct. The analysis in a summary judgment in a non-infringement case is first to do the proper claim construction, and then second to apply that claim construction to the accused device. A review of the district court's order makes it clear that their basis for summary judgment was on the latter half of that. We know that because in each instance, what's being compared is the accused device, the cat shelter, and whether or not the claim elements are present in that cat shelter. There's nothing in the district court's opinion that suggests that any of the claims are ambiguous or unclear. There's nothing in the court's opinion that suggests that there's anything in the specification that limits the scope or disavows the scope of their claim. The court's sole analysis is in weighing whether or not the expert's testimony with respect to whether the presence of those limitations in the cat shelter is sufficient. The court in that analysis improperly weighed credibility, improperly weighed the evidence.
Well, put aside the use of the word credibility,
right,
in which does sound like something is not done on summary judgment. But I suppose one read the district court's decision to be saying your only evidence as to support is evidence about some kind of support that in any common sense way is not the kind that this patent is talking about. This kind is talking about support from underneath, and you don't even have evidence of that.
Right. Well, Your Honor, I would point to a couple things. First, if the court were to have done that, they would run afoul of claim construction, because the claims define the rails in the claim of the 001 patent as being a component part of the shelter. So since those rails in the 001 patent are supporting it on the substrate, there can't, by definition,
well,
be anything.
I thought most of the summary judgment case turned on construction of the word support, and the court said that support here is as a person with ordinary skill in the art would see it, and not the various mathematical axioms that, like Newton's law and Hooke's law, that your expert was advocating.
Your Honor, but then again, you still, even before you consider any extrinsic evidence, like the testimony from the experts, you have to look at the claim language itself. And the clear, unambiguous claim language makes a rail the component part of the shelter. And because a rail is a component part of the shelter that supports the shelter on a substrate, by definition, there cannot be anything underneath it. The other thing that I would point the court to with respect to this support argument is that the court makes clear how it's defining support by use of the analogy that it provides. And the analogy it provides is a tabletop can't be seen to support the table legs. There's only one problem with that analogy.
It says that, use an analogy to say support, when you look at the legs of a table, it's evident that the legs support the tabletop. Your argument is that the tabletop support the legs, and therefore there's the support is circular.
I would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor. What, and it was a misnomer in the court's opinion, and maybe wasn't as clear in the briefs as it should have been. The district court clearly found that there may be a fact question with respect to the definition of rails, and whether or not the rails, as Mr. Pirtle defined them, were rails within the meaning of the patent. And Mr. Pirtle very clearly defines rail to be the combination of a vertical plate, a floor plate, and an angle plate all coupled together to function as a rail. So Mr. Pirtle, in his definition of rail, which the court acknowledged a fact question about, has the bottom component of the rail being the floor plate in contact with the substrate. And in his declaration, he clearly states that floor plate, the rail, as I have defined it, is in contact with the substrate. Thus, the proper analogy for the court to have made is not whether a tabletop supports the table legs, it's whether the table, once you couple the tabletop to the table legs, whether that table supports what you put on it. It's you've already assumed the definition of rail. The court used only a definition of rail that presupposes there's something underneath the rail. Mr. Pirtle never testified that there was anything underneath the rail. He very clearly, plainly, and unambiguously testified that the rail was made up of three component parts, the floor plate, the vertical plate, and the angle plate. And importantly, Your Honor, something I would point out to you is, if Kat wanted to controvert that evidence, if Kat wanted to show that's not correct, given his definition of rail, and given the fact that the court hadn't construed rail to have a specific meaning, Mr. Skates would have provided a declaration that said how Mr. Pirtle has defined rail cannot be a rail. He didn't do that.
Can I take you back and ask you to first open together a picture, if there is one, of the accused product,
and then
walk me through what the accused rails are and how it's supporting, doing the supporting required.
I will. If you will go to...
It would help me to be looking at something. The words start to blur.
I would start with A298.
A298?
Appendix 298. Sorry.
Oh, there's two drawings on here.
Correct. In the bottom drawing, you see justified in red, designated rail in red, how Mr. Pirtle has defined the rail, showing that it clearly includes the floor plate. And then in the illustration where he has the yellow, he has the portion of plate 7 that transfers the rail, the lobes of the rail in yellow, which he has shown as being out, and then they go into the floor plate.
That's in the...
I'm sorry, you're using colors, and the appendix doesn't have colors.
Okay. It's also in Mr. Pirtle's report, in his declaration.
Is this what's on page 13 of your brief, which is colorful?
You're not.
Is it this?
That looks to be it, correct.
Okay.
And the district court recognized there was a fact question with respect to rail. That rail is clearly in contact with the substrate. So when they're testifying, when Mr. Skates is construing or is talking about support, in every instance he says the rail is pushing down on the floor plate. He never acknowledges that Mr. Pirtle has defined the entire thickness of the outer portion of that floor plate to be a component part of the rail. And this is important, and it does have to do with Hooke's Law. Your Honor, Hooke's Law is a recognized, universally accepted law of engineering. And what Mr. Pirtle testified to was, Hooke's Law stands for the proposition that the stiffer an element is, the more load that element supports. And in this system, in calculations he provided, it showed that the rail portion, the red portion of that, and if you look at section AA, you'll see the rails are on the two outside portions, and the remainder of the floor plate is what's in between the two rails.
You're into your rebuttal time. You can go on if you want.
I'll go on just a little further.
Okay.
And so what he testified to was that Hooke's Law says the stiffer an element is, the more load it supports. And then he provided calculations that show those two rails, as he has defined them, carry 75 times stiffer than the portion of the floor plate between the rails. And so that more than 75 times the load that is placed upon that shelter is carried by those two component part rails that are on the outside of the shelter.
Sir, and the shelter in this drawing is what?
You can see, let me turn to page 13. I think in that drawing, Your Honor, it doesn't have the enclosure that is on top. I think you're just seeing the skid there as opposed to having the enclosure on top. If you look back at A298, the top and bottom drawing there showed the enclosure on top of it. The rail is the complete component part. The protective shelter is all of those elements. The wall, the ceiling, the rails, the decks on either side are all component parts of the protective shelter as defined by the claims and by the specification. If there are other questions, I'll reserve.
Well, the court said that they didn't dispute with Newton's law.
Right.
And with Hooke's law, or maybe even the application of the expert of those laws. But it just went back looking at the claims and at the patent, and it disagreed with your expert. The court disagreed with your expert conclusion that this created a support for the shelter. And I'm looking now at A11. It says, and finds that a person of ordinary skill in the art would have the same disagreement. As using the patent terminology, this is not what support is referring to.
Right. There's nothing, I would note the court makes no reference to anything in the specification as not being what it's referring to.
No, it's referring to your expert's testimony and the...
Right. But it's saying that there's nothing, it's saying that's not what the patent is referring to when it says support. But it points to nothing in the specification and nothing in the claim language that would support or buttress the court's interpretation of that language to mean that it has to be from underneath or it wasn't consistent with what my expert testified to. And in fact, in his expert report, and I'll have this cite when I come back up in my rebuttal, but my expert specifically testifies about how the rail supports the load of the shelter, weight and wind overturning moment. And that is what it's talking about support. So when the court says holds up, when my expert says support in structural engineering means to oppose forces moving it in a direction, when this shelter is sitting on the ground, the only force moving on it is the weight of the protective shelter moving against the ground. So the only thing opposing that force is the rails and the floor plate in between, but the rails are carrying 75% of that load. That's what's providing the support, as shown by Hooke's law and as shown straightforward in his testimony, and the court offers no basis for contradicting that. And once again, when you're looking at the accused product, that's an analysis of, not the rails in the protective shelter, that's an analysis of the accused product. And once you're doing the accused product, it's a de novo review, and every inference has to be construed in favor of the evidence that was presented. I'll reserve
that. Okay. All right, thank you. Mr. Cooper?
Yes, Your Honor. And please, the court. The design of the CAD structure is very, very simple. It is a plate of metal. A circular cylinder is welded into the middle. And what he calls rails, these are basically walls along the side for the filling concrete. That, in essence, is the design of the CAD structure.
Do the rails touch the cylinder?
They go along the side. The cylinder, actually, if you look on page A296, there's one at the top. It actually goes out, the cylinder goes out to the very edge of the plate, full plate. And so it comes up, when it comes up, Judge Toronto, and actually they will touch it. But it sits there independent of the rails. The rails are there because you're pouring the concrete in as a ballast. It's sort of like a cake pan. If you didn't have sides on your cake pan, you poured your batter in, it would spill out everywhere. That is what the side walls on this. Now, they're saying, well, these are really rails. Their product
The district court didn't conclude did it, that the things accused of being rails are not rails.
Refer to them as walls, side walls.
Right, but to find non-infringement as a matter of summary judgment, the district court had to say, here is a claim element that cannot, as a matter of law, be found in the accused product. It didn't find the absence of rails, right?
The court did not. The court said there may be a fact issue as to rails, but he never got there because
okay.
he didn't have.
So he said, all right, I'm going to assume they're rails, but the rails don't support.
They don't support.
Now, what don't they support?
Okay. Their product has rails underneath there that actually lift the platform off the ground because they have some theory regarding aerodynamics that when there's a tornado, the wind will come underneath and come up through a hole in the middle, and that will somehow, through aerodynamic forces, force their product down to the ground. And so they actually have elongated rails running the length of their floor to support it, to hold it up off of the ground. What was done in this case, there were two experts. Gates was ours, Colonel was theirs. And one of the things the trial court did was what would an ordinary person, skilled in the craft, interpret support to mean? Because theirs is these rails basically sit on the ground. Well, basically, ours sits on the ground, and the rails or the walls sit on the product. And the court said that was not support because if it was, then everything would be support. It would have no meaning, and he must interpret the patent and the language in the patent as having a meaning.
Well, they make their. I will confess, I don't really understand this. So, but they make some attempt to say the rails are performing some kind of rigidity strengthening function, and the more rigid the thing is that has been strengthened, the more support will occur, and so maybe by two steps.
That was addressed by Mr. Skates.
Can you explain it in terms I might hope to understand?
What they're trying to say is that if we welded these sidewalls and welded the welds, it made the plate stiffer, the bottom plate, the bottom floor stiffer.
On which your cylinder sits.
On which the cylinder sits. But we had Skates' affidavit who said, look, there is a difference between reinforcement and support. Support, according to the common understood term, is to lift up. Reinforce is a different concept. It is to stiffen or whatever. And while their expert may have some argument that it stiffens and reinforces, it doesn't support, it doesn't hold up the cylinder and the floor in this particular case.
So what evidence? I mean, since we don't have a kind of a dispute about science between the experts, we have at most a dispute about meaning. And it seems to me, if we're talking about the meaning of the word support outside the context of the patent, it can have any number of different meanings. So we have to be talking about meaning in the context of the patent. So what is it in this patent that makes it clear, and I'm not sure that this is actually a factual question because it's intra-patent coherence interpretation, which we have said is not, and the Supreme Court has said is not a factual question. What aspect of the patent says what we mean in the patent, or indicates what we mean in the patent by support, is hold up in the kind of sense you were talking about?
Well, I think...
Hold up from the bottom.
Intrinsic in the patent, I'm not so sure there's anything there. I think the court then looked at the experts to see what someone skilled in this area at the time of the invention would have interpreted to mean.
Well, the claims do use the word elevate.
Claim 60 uses elevate. 44, 89, 94, I think, do not use the term elevate. But they do use the term elevate, which Skates...
I thought it's just claim 60 that uses the term elevate. And we've got that's only one claim. Support is the word that you need for the other 15 claims or something.
Support is through all the claims. Elevate and ballast was with respect to claim 60. That is correct.
So what is it in the patent that indicates that you just have to understand support here to mean? How do you finish the sentence? Support to mean what?
To hold up to lift up.
Scaffolding would hold up a facade that you want to preserve when you've taken out the rest of the building and you want to build something behind it. And you have scaffolding, and it's not underneath. Scaffolding will be on the side. It's supporting the facade.
Well, I guess in certain circumstances.
Right. That's one perfectly ordinary meaning. Of course it's supporting it.
It would hold up a building from falling over, sort of like flying buttresses at Notre Dame Cathedral.
Right.
We have them coming up from the ground. They hold up the walls.
Right, and they're not underneath. So
they're not underneath, but they hold up. They support the walls. They hold it up. And so what the dictionary definition said in this case, what Skate said in this case, what the court found in trying to determine the credibility between the two experts was that if you use their expert, then anything that has thickness would provide support. And you would render, under Hurdle's definition, the term support could be anything. Anything that has thickness, it has weight or whatever, would theoretically be support, and it would have no meaning. And the court said, in order to interpret the patent, it must have some meaning, and decided that the credibility was with Mr. Skates and was not with Mr. Hurdle. Now, counsel argues, well, can the court determine credibility? Yes, the court can determine credibility when it's determining what a person in the similar art would have interpreted to be. The court did that in the Teva case. There were two experts. The court selected one over the other in the construction of the patent. This court dealt with it on remand. When you have that, contrary to what counsel says, when you're looking at factual issues, that is what a person of average skill in the art would apply the patent at the time of the invention, that is a fact issue. That is something the trial court can make a decision on, and the review by this court, as the Supreme Court has said and as this court held on remand, is not de novo. Rather, it is clearly erroneous or clear error. And the question is, when the trial court in this case said, I find that Mr. Hurdle's interpretation would render the term, in this case, support meaningless, and I'm going to adopt the term and the definition that was given by Mr. Skates, you know, is it clearly erroneous? Is it clear error in that factual determination? And if it's not, and we don't believe it is, then Judge Kincaid is entitled to have his factual determination upheld. And we believe that if you look at the briefing, if you look at the drawings, their definition given by Mr. Hurdle makes absolutely no sense. He had the same problem with the term ballast. He said, for example, on ballast, that only the top micron of the floor is the floor, and that since the floor has thickness, the thickness is the ballast. And again, our expert, Judge Kincaid, said, well, under this definition, anything that adds weight, the cylinder, the top, the door, all of that, theoretically, would be ballast, and you're rendering the term meaningless.
Right, it seemed to me on the term ballast that they had at least one theory under which it's admittedly hard to see how it could never be false. But it seems to me they also have a narrower theory, which is in the accused product, weight has been added to the material making up the floor for some purpose, like giving it weight, different from allowing it to serve the function that floors serve, namely having stuff on them without the stuff falling through.
Correct. But the floor that served the floor was a functional floor. And I was thinking
so the additional weight, it seems to me, could be viewed as ballast without making the term meaningless.
Well, then every weight then, as the court talked about, trial court, would be ballast. And the question is, let's assume...
Only weight unnecessary to the purpose of allowing the plank to serve as a floor.
Well, then let's assume that instead of using steel, which they use in this case, they could have used aluminum, which is lighter. And then the question is the fact, let's say it was still a 3/8 inch floor, the fact that they used a material that was heavier than other materials that are out there, which is the case, does that make it ballast as well? And again, I think the court looked at this. The court looked at their definition of ballast and concluded that basically anything, including the top of the cylinder, the doors, the hand towels, even in the cylinder, could be ballast under Mr. Hurdle's definition. And you know, the court never got to the issue of the fact that the ballast must be beneath the floor. In our case, as described earlier, there was a plate and there was these sidewalls and the ballast, the concrete, was poured on top. Under theirs, they had places underneath the floor where you could add ballast if there was a need to add ballast. Again, the court never got to the issue of the location of the ballast because the court concluded that the concrete or the other items such as the floor or whatever were not ballast. I mean, we know going back in the early 1800s, ships, when they come across with their products and they go back, they had to put ballast in to keep it stable. They put rocks in there, and we see along a lot of coastal towns, there's a lot of rocks which used to be ballast. Now, the question is, okay, if we made the ship with thicker timbers or whatever, would the thickness of the timbers be ballast? No. Ballast were there to provide extra weight and serve no other purpose but to add extra weight to the particular ship. And I think that is true with respect to the case at hand. We believe under the applicable standards set forth by the Supreme Court and by this court in Tebow, this was inherently a factual issue for the trial judge. Construction of the patent is a question of law.
If it's a factual issue for the trial judge, what do you mean? He decided this on summary judgment. Are you telling me that the judge considered two sides of an argument of facts?
Under TIVA, under the construction of the patent, the question of the meaning that a person of the ordinary skill would have can be...
Is that a factual issue under patent law?
Well, in the TIVA case, the court said it could be an issue of fact, a subsidiary issue of fact.
Meaning, in this case, the judge decided the case on his evaluation of what one with ordinary skill in the art would view as support, and then he found the plaintiff's expert testimony not to be credible because of that. Isn't that just automatically you're putting issues of fact in controversy?
Absolutely not.
Why shouldn't a jury have decided this?
Because it is up to the trial court to construe the patents what the terms mean. And we have the experts come in to assist and provide underpinnings, background to the court. And in the TIVA case, we had the same thing. We had two experts. The court discredited one, believed the other. And on the original appeal, the question was, did this court review the decision of the trial court to credit one and discredit the other under the correct standard, which was the clear standard?
I'll be a little forthright. I think I came in here thinking more strongly about your position, and you've kind of weakened it through your oral argument. You're almost now showing that the court disregarded that there's a genuine issue, a material fact in dispute.
This is this court's decision in the Tito case. The reviewing court, however, should review subsidiary factual findings under the clearly erroneous standard. The court explained that when the district court reviews only evidence intrinsic to the patent, it's a question of law. If the district court needs to consult extrinsic evidence, for example, to understand the meaning
of this is not a case involving, at this point of our discussion, claim construction. It's summary judgment.
But the question is, the court has to construe the term of the patent first. Then the question is, okay, is there a fact issue, once you've construed the patent, that would raise an issue? When he construed the patent the way that he did in our client's favor, there was no fact issue except the evidence.
Yeah, but he's going to say differently.
But it was based upon an incorrect construction of the patent. If that were true, all you'd have to have is two experts, and you would never have a summary judgment in a patent case because you can always get someone to advocate a contrary construction.
Do you have a closing thought? You're out of time.
I'm out of time. We believe in this case the trial court applied the Tebbit case, did what he was supposed to do. We had a basis for what he did, and a clear error standard, as this court has articulated in Tebbit, his ruling was not erroneous.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, please, court. Mrs. Toronto, you mentioned scaffolding. The other thing that I would point out, being in California and honor the court being out here, a little bit north of here, there's a bridge over a bay that's held by suspension cables from above. No structural engineer would contest that that bridge is supported by those cables, which are above it. To read into this claim a requirement that the support comes from beneath is completely unjustified by the clear language of the claim terms.
Can you make an attempt, one more attempt, by looking at the picture, and if this is the picture on page 13 of your brief, or 298, or some better picture of the accused product, and walk through in common sense terms what your theory is of why the rails support the shelter?
Right. Your Honor, if I can cheat a little bit, I would refer you to...
Depends what kind of cheating you have in mind.
Appendix A276, where our expert...
276. Yeah, does it have a picture?
It does not have a picture.
Right, you got to do it with the picture.
But it goes with the picture. It explains the picture.
Well, use the words. So I'll look at the picture.
What he is saying is the bottom floor plate is in contact with the ground.
I'm with you.
All right. The weight of the shelter is pushing down. The weight of the earth pushes against that. In engineering terms and structure, there is no orientation. I mean, the earth pushes against you, you push against the earth. That's what Newton's third law is. There's no dispute that's what Newton's third law is. And I would take a little issue with there being no dispute of science in this case.
Your experts are arguing that there's a force downward. The floor is here. And if you push down, Newton's law is for every action. There's an equal reaction. And therefore, the floor now is pushing up against this, and that's the support. And that's what the judge said that it can be.
What it's, to the extent the judge is saying that, it's a clearly erroneous determination. What the expert is saying is that floor plate that lays on the ground, just like the table legs and the tabletop, is holding up the weight of what's on top of it. And then what our expert has said is, when you couple that by putting a vertical plate and welding it together and welding an angle plate, what you've now done is made the outer portions of that skid 75 times stiffer than the portion in between where those two rails are. And under Hooke's law, which was not controverted, their expert didn't say Hooke's
and
law.
And therefore what? Forget about Hooke's law. Therefore what?
All right. Because it's 75 times stiffer, what that means is that the weight of that protective shelter is being held up by those outside rails. And I'll try to give you a simple example of this. If I were to take two books and put the two books side by side, and then I were to put really soft peanuts, like packing peanuts, and I put those packing peanuts between those two books,
On the ground or something?
Yeah, on the ground.
Okay.
On the ground, on the table, I put two books side by side of equal height. I put packing peanuts in between to the same height as the two books. And then I put an ice cooler that weighs 200 pounds on top of it. What he's saying is the books are carrying the load, not the peanuts, because those styrofoam peanuts would be compressed, and they're not being compressed because the books are a lot stiffer than the peanuts in between are. So on these rails, when you put these two rails onto
okay,
that plate...
I will say, that I get.
Okay.
Thank you.
and then real quick, with respect to the ballast limitation, you were dead on this.
The experts didn't testify as to what that hypothetical that you just posed.
No, the expert provided Hooke's Law and said Hooke's Law stands for the proposition that the stiffness tells you where the weight is being carried, because Hooke's Law says... that the stiffer the object is, the more weight it carries. It didn't provide that analogy. You're absolutely correct.
Okay. Can you give us your concluding thoughts?
Yes, Your Honor. Clearly what the district court did was do an infringement analysis that you're absolutely correct about. It is for the jury if there's any basis for a factual dispute. What counsel was talking about with respect to subsidiary findings goes to claim interpretation, and you can only use extrinsic evidence if there's an ambiguity with respect to the terms and the intrinsic evidence, and you can't use extrinsic evidence to contradict the interpretation you would have from the claims or the intrinsic evidence. Exactly to his point, you can get an expert to say anything. So if it's not an ambiguity of the terms itself and the intrinsic evidence, you don't even consider contrary extrinsic evidence.
Okay.
Yep.
Yes, thank you.